Whakalofalahiatu, ko korowa kauta he hungoa haku. You're listening to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. Coming up, a measles epidemic is declared in Samoa. The laws after former PNG Prime Minister Peter O'Neill again. Vanuatu could take polluters to world court. Niuans in New Zealand target youth during Language Week. And traditional Russian costumes meet Melanesian design. Samoa's government has declared a measles epidemic. It says 7 cases have been confirmed and the death of a 1-year-old last week is also likely to be because of measles. The Health Ministry says it anticipates more cases and is urging people to get vaccinated in clinics across the country. A vaccinologist at Auckland University, Helen Patousis-Harris, says a measles outbreak in Samoa was basically inevitable. She says Samoa has an immunisation rate as low as 31%, which may have dropped further because of a lengthy pause in the vaccination program last year. Dr. Patousis-Harris told Jamie Tahana about her initial reaction to the outbreak.
Oh, disappointment. A disappointment that this has happened. This has been a fear that we've had, given both the very low immunisation coverage in Samoa and the epidemic that New Zealand has been experiencing. It's really been a matter of time before, unfortunately, the disease was introduced into the Samoan community.
Vaccination rates vary at about 30%, aren't they, and fallen in the past 10 years or so.
They will have suffered as a result of the events last year, where, of course, they had the disaster with 2 infants died, and their immunisation programme was halted for quite some months. And, of course, people have lost a lot of confidence as well. So the uptake was not that good, and I think now it's probably a little worse.
How likely is it that it's come from the outbreak we've got in Auckland at the moment?
What I understand is that there have been some cases there that have been directly linked to cases in New Zealand.
Since this outbreak in Auckland started, it's been quite a concern of Pacific governments, hasn't it? So how vulnerable are they?
Well, any community, even a community here that has low levels of immunity to measles, are vulnerable when measles is walking around. And, of course, our biggest outbreak has been in the South Auckland area, where we've got a lot of people from the Pacific, and I guess there's also a lot of people visiting from that area. So the chances of the disease being imported into Samoa was very high.
And so what does Samoa have to do now, I guess? We've got it now and it spreads like wildfire. What's the best method of action?
Well, there's the basic sort of infection control measures and contacting people who've come into contact with those cases. That's a very big job. Making sure that those people who've been in contact are immune. Making sure people who have not been immune are quarantined. Or isolated, that don't go out in the community for a couple of weeks. So there's those measures which are really important. And then there is the need to vaccinate, and they've got very, very low coverage. So in order to stop the transmission of this disease, you actually need about 95% of your community immune to stop the disease from being transferred from one person to another. They have nowhere near that level of immunity in their community. So a mass immunisation campaign will be a vital component of trying to control this, I should imagine.
That's Auckland University's Helen Patousis-Harris. An arrest warrant has been issued for Papua New Guinea's former Prime Minister, the Yalubu Pangia MP Peter O'Neill. But PNG's Acting Police Commissioner David Manning has said Mr O'Neill has so far refused to cooperate with the police over investigations into alleged corruption. Johnny Blades has been following the events and he spoke to Jamie Tahana.
Police investigators probing a corruption case were granted a warrant for Peter O'Neill's arrest by the District Court last Friday. The Police Commissioner isn't giving away a lot of details. He just says it's too sensitive to go into details at this point in time. Suffice to say that he said investigators have enough evidence to push for this warrant successfully. But he's also added that the former Prime Minister had been holed up in a Port Moresby hotel, the rather swanky Crown Plaza, effectively denying police access to him for them to request for him to go in for questioning.
And so what has Peter O'Neill had to say about all this from the Crown Plaza?
Well, he's denied that police have asked him to go in at all. He says he's available for any matter, but he said that this case is basically a political power play engineered by the police minister, Brian Cramer, who's definitely O'Neill's sort of nemesis in the political scene over there. He has also said that this matter that it relates to is about a health clinic in Madang, which is Cramer's province, and he's saying that there was no wrongdoing and that this has been sort of clumsily put together as some sort of attempt to bring him down. And again, he said that he is, in fact, available for police questioning. At this point, the police haven't responded further.
This is not the first time police have sought to arrest Peter O'Neill, though, is it, in relation to a corruption case? They didn't get far with previous attempts. What's different this time?
Yeah, well, you're alluding to the Paraka payments saga, which stretches right back in terms of police seeking to arrest Peter O'Neill to 2014, and he successfully challenged the validity of that arrest warrant in court, but it tied up the whole matter in court for years. And in the meantime, Peter O'Neill's government removed the police commissioner at the time. In fact, they removed two police commissioners, and this whole process of kind of sidelining effectively the fraud squad whose investigation the arrest warrant attempt stemmed from. And so that was not really a good look in terms of the government professing to be targeting corruption or wanting to counter corruption. So that was when O'Neill was prime minister. Now, of course, he's no longer prime minister. He was replaced in May by his former close ally, James Marape, after O'Neill was sort of forced to resign when the bulk of his coalition government essentially deserted him in parliament. So he's no longer prime minister. Some would say that seems to remove that shield of protection he enjoyed for a few years.
Is it too early to write Mr. O'Neill off, though?
I think so. He's a resourceful operator, I think you'd have to say. So at the least, you could expect some court action, perhaps from his legal team, to challenge this. The other aspect we need to keep in mind is that there is a Supreme Court challenge underway, which Beldon Nama, the opposition leader, has taken over from Patrick Paresh, the former opposition leader recently, challenging that May election of James Marape in Parliament. I think, again, that's on a technicality. But that's to be heard later this month in the Supreme Court. And if the court does overturn the election of Marape, that could open the way for a new vote for Prime Minister in the Parliament. And, you know, Peter O'Neill has his allies, and as I say, he's quite resourceful. I wouldn't count him out politically just yet. He showed in the budget debates he's still right in the thick of things and he wants to lead, so too early to write him off.
That was Johnny Blades. A leading climate scientist says Vanuatu's quest to hold polluters to account could lie before the International Court of Justice. Vanuatu's Foreign Minister Ralph Reginvanu last year said his government was considering legal action against fossil fuel corporations and countries. In September, Vanuatu invited legal experts from around the world to discuss possible avenues for the lawsuit. At the event was Columbia Law School Professor Michael Gerard, who told Mackenzie Smith efforts are focused on the World Court.
The International Court of Justice could be asked to issue an advisory opinion that would, for example, clarify what are the obligations of the major emitting countries to current and future generations to make sure that the climate is livable and particularly to make sure that the small island nations don't drown.
What would that mean in terms of the prospect of actual legal action taking place?
The International Court of Justice does not have enforcement power. It can't issue money damages or that kind of thing. However, its decisions are very influential in courts around the world. There are courts in several different countries that are now adjudicating the obligation of emitters in their own countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. A decision from the International Court of Justice could be quite powerful in influencing those domestic courts.
What kind of backing would Vanuatu need to push this forward?
In order to get in front of the International Court of Justice, it would be necessary to have a vote of the majority of the members present of the UN General Assembly. So it would need practically 100 countries to agree with it.
So does that seem like a bit of a long shot, maybe?
Numerous questions have been presented to the International Court of Justice by the UN General Assembly. Problem is that here several countries would actively oppose it, and that poses some obstacles. In 2013, the Republic of the Marshall Islands and Tuvalu wanted to get in front of the ICJ, but the U.S. actively opposed it. The U.S. is now perhaps less influential in global affairs than it was at that time, so it's not clear whether U.S. opposition would be as decisive as it was then.
What do you make of the prospects for other Pacific Island states wanting to engage in legal action to kind of fund their efforts against climate change? I mean, is there any hope there?
Well, the principal method that the small island states in the Pacific have been using to try to get funding for their efforts has been through the UN climate negotiations, trying to get what's called loss and damage, trying to get money to address the problems caused by climate change. Unfortunately, although there's been a lot of talk of loss and damage by the developing countries that would receive the money, none of the developed countries that would have to pay out the money have gone along with it. None of them have agreed to make these payments, and it can't be forced upon them. It would have to be by their consent.
That's climate scientist Professor Michael Gerard. Niuans across New Zealand have been celebrating their culture and language this week. Much of the onus for keeping the language alive is on the nearly 24,000 Niuans in New Zealand, with under 2,000 people living on the island itself. This year's theme is Tukiofa Ofenia Mukaina Evangahau Niue, Treasure, Love and Cherish the Niuan Language. Christine Ruvoi reports.
That's young Niuans performing at the launch of their Language Week in Auckland last weekend. Niue-born Wellington-based Dr. Alvin Mitukulena says his language is not spoken widely compared to other Pacific languages, but he says there has been an increasing number of young Niuans taking an interest in the language and culture.
It's quite heartwarming to see that, and I hope it just only gets stronger. For me, it's just being able to get together with my community, share stories about our home island. It's a time of reflection, coming together with the community, with other Niue people, and just sharing stories about our homeland, what we remember, what we can pass on to young Niuans as well.
The chairperson of the Wangahau Niue, Mailingi Hetutu, says the organisers have been impressed with the response from the community.
The highlight was the youth who take part in the service as well, with singing, reading, even preaching. There was a young man who was so powerful on his messages to his young friends about maintaining Niue language and keep using it. His encouragement is for the New Zealand-born Niueans to try and learn the Wangahau.
Ms. Hetutu says they will continue to work with and encourage the youth to learn the Wangahau. New Zealand's Pacific Peoples Minister says more needs to be done to expand the use of Pacific languages beyond language weeks. Aupito Williams-Seal says while such weeks remain important, more investment and research is needed to help struggling languages.
What we'll do with that is basically start from our starting point in the Pacific Language Weeks and continue to build on that as the community directs us, which requires us to make sure that the language weeks are better coordinated on a nationwide basis, but also it will require us to look to the source of the language.
Aupito Seo, whose ministry runs the 7 Pacifica Language Weeks, says $20 million New Zealand dollars has been allocated for further research and language support. Dr. Alvin Mitukulena urges young Niueans to make use of every opportunity and ask their parents, grandparents and friends for assistance in learning the language.
Because it is a dying language, I hate to say that, but it is, and we need to try and revive it. But we all have a responsibility as Niue people. Part of learning the language is about making some mistakes, because that's the only way you're going to learn. But we as, you know, people who are fluent, we have a responsibility to help our young people and encourage them and be supportive of them when they want to learn our language.
Nguyen Language Week ends on Saturday when the Islanders mark their Aho Pule Whakamotu or Constitution Day, when Nguyen became a self-governing nation in 1974. Koe hionga ha'aku ko, Christine Ravoy, Mutolukia.
A Russian cultural foundation has been in Papua New Guinea this month, exhibiting and teaching Russian culture, language and history. The Mikluho Maclay Foundation is named after Nicholas Mikluho Maclay, a Russian explorer, ethnologist, anthropologist and biologist, who was one of the earliest foreign scientists to settle and study in New Guinea 150 years ago. His descendant Nikolai is currently in PNG, overseeing a number of exhibitions and events, including a run at PNG Fashion Week, where traditional Russian costumes met Melanesian design. Mr. Mikluho Maclay's great-great-grandfather wrote numerous books about PNG and contributed richly to the first wave of knowledge about New Guinea in Russia. He spoke to Johnny Blades about his attempts to carry on that work.
The main idea is to organize the relationship between Papua New Guinea and Russia, because I remember about Mikluho Maclay, who was first explorer in Medenk. He wrote a lot of books about this region. He explained for all the world that Papua New Guinea are very friendly. And my idea is same. I have not so many information in Russia about Papua New Guinea now. And this event we organized because we want to explain about Russia also. Renewing cultures and the education ties between Russia and Papua New Guinea, to offer and encourage them to start learning Russian and regular basic.
You want Papua New Guineans to learn Russian. How will they do that? Where can you learn Russian in Papua New Guinea?
Right now we organize a language course. I invited a teacher from Russia, and we started this course in National Library. Every day, four times in a day, the Papua New Guinea National Library in Port Moresby. They are partners, and they give time when we can invite students from UPNG University, from other places, any people who want. And our teacher from Russia, step by step, explain how we can learn Russian.
What would you say to someone who's thinking, why should I learn Russian? I mean, what's in it for a Papua New Guinean?
You know, before we start this project, I thought that we can invite maybe 20, 30, 50 maximum people. And especially for that, we organize an exhibition, explain about Russia, what the culture, Russian culture, and ask about people who want to know more, application where was some questions, and one question was, do you want to learn Russian? And I thought that it's not so many people who want to start, but we collect 1,050 people for the last 3 days, and I think that people want to know because first of all, it is first time in Papua New Guinea. Second, because they can know more about world history and read the Russian book. And also they can visit Russia and also start get a Russian education also. When I talk with Papua New Guinea, they want to know more about Russian education and about others. And because in Papua New Guinea, many people who know 2, 3, 4, 5 languages, they really understand that if they want to communicate with someone, they should speak in language, and that's why they, I think that's why they want to start learn Russia.
Are there products from Papua New Guinea which could be exported into Russia? You know, there's some amazing food in Papua New Guinea, for instance.
Absolutely. And for me, for example, coffee and papaya, it's amazing, and I like it very much. I can't tell you exactly about what the economic relationship will be between our two countries, because we just start. And I'm sure that when our Prime Minister will meet next year, they can decide what's way of interesting for our countries.
That's Nicolai Makluho McLay. And that's Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koro Vakauta. Whakaue he whakanongonongo mai.